Hey, good evening, everyone. I'm broadcasting live March 14th. Today's quote is from the Pajjalayamana Sutta. It's from the Anguttara Nikaya. It's really a pretty neat sutta. First and foremost, because of the practical advice it gives on dealing with drowsiness, which we all deal with in our meditation practice, especially when on a meditation course. And so the Buddha gives a list of 8 ways to deal with drowsiness. That's in the Anguttara Book of Sevens, so only the first 7 are considered to be actually dealing with the problem. We'll see what the 8th is. But the sutta has more than just that, so we'll go through everything in the sutta. So this is, we have to understand that this is before, this is about Moggallana, who was the second chief disciple of the Buddha. The two chief disciples were Sariputta and Moggallana. Sariputta was known for his wisdom, and Moggallana was known for his mental powers. So he had a lot of, the claim is that he had a lot of supernormal powers, ability to fly through the air and change his form and do all sorts of magical things that maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but that's what he's famous for. He's also actually less famous, though important, for a couple of discourses, at least one that I can think of. There's the Anumana Sutta, the inference discourse on inference that is actually quite important, where he's teaching monks. It's tradition that Sariputta and Moggallana were thought of as mother and nurse to the monks. So Sariputta would give birth to them by leading them up to become sotapannas. So giving them their first birth as enlightened beings. And then Moggallana would raise them up to become arahants. So they work together. Sariputta would do the first work of giving birth to them, and Moggallana would raise them. So they were friends before they became monks. There's a long story about these two monks that you can actually find the life of Sariputta and the life of Moggallana, I think, online. Very much worth reading. But it's important, this sutta actually takes place before Moggallana, before their enlightenment, after they had become monks, but before they had become enlightened. So the Buddha was dwelling among the Bhagas at Sumaragira in the deer park at Vesakala Grove. Moggallana was sitting dozing. He was staying at Kalawalamuttagama, the village of Kalawalamutta, among the Magadans. And the Buddha saw through his magical powers that Moggallana was dozing, and so he sent forth a image of himself, or actually he teleported himself to Moggallana. Maybe that didn't happen, I don't know. Many people, I think, are skeptical of such things. But at any rate, he came to Moggallana and said to him, asked him, Pajjalasi, what did he say? Pajjalayasi no tuang Moggallana? Pajjalayasi no tuang Moggallana? Are you nodding? Mogalana, are you nodding? Evang Bhante, he replied. Yes, Venerable Sir, it is so, Venerable Sir. And he said, then the Buddha gave him eight methods, which, you know, are good for all of us. If you're nodding, if you're feeling drowsy when you meditate, you should do one of seven things. First of all, the first thing you should do is you should stop attending to the object you were attending to when you became drowsy. So figure out what it was that you were focusing on when you became drowsy and switch that. So maybe you were focusing on the body, you can instead focus on the mind. Maybe you were focusing on the feelings, you can instead focus on the dhammas. You can switch. Because it is possible that your meditation object is making you drowsy. And so you want to stay awake, so you find another object. But if that doesn't work, then there are a series of ways that you can change gears. Because often you find that you get into a rut. The falling asleep is interesting because the body gets into a gear, a rut. And sometimes all it takes is switching gears and suddenly you're awake. Like, you know, when you suddenly have a shock and you're suddenly totally awake. Well, how did that happen? You know, you were tired and suddenly the tired disappears. This is actually how the body works, it seems. If you can switch gears, suddenly you'll have energy. So there are ways to do this. One way is to consider the Dhamma. Think about the Buddha's teaching. So have some time to reflect upon the four foundations of mindfulness, or the three characteristics, or and think about the Eightfold Noble Path or the Four Noble Truths. Think about the Dhamma, because sometimes that wakes you up. Sometimes that excites you, or gives you energy, or reminds you, sets your mind back on the right track. But if that doesn't work, you should recite the Dhamma. Now, this one is really powerful. And it's a good reason to learn chanting. You learn to chant the Dhamma, like chant the, even just praise of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, their good qualities. Iti piso bhagava arhang samma sambuddho. It's sort of, you know, it's along the lines, actually, of why people sing when they're driving. They'll sing along with the radio and it keeps them awake. Because it's exciting. But even more powerful is for a person who appreciates the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, is to recite the Buddha, so praise of the Buddha or his teachings, or not praise, but remember the good qualities, reflect on the good qualities. Or just recite the Dhamma, whatever Dhamma you know, recite verses or suttas. All of that is very good, because not only does the act of doing it excite you and wake you up, but also the content is inspiring. And that makes it a really good tool for waking you up. If that doesn't work, then the Buddha says you should pull both ears and rub your limbs with your hands. Now, this is a physical means. So the Buddha is actually quite practical here. If that doesn't work, you should get up, rub your eyes with water, look in all directions, look up at the stars, and try and wake yourself up. Maybe take a deep breath. And wake yourself up that way. If that doesn't work, you should attend to the perception of light. This is an interesting one that I've studied, and I'm not still not quite sure what it means, but there's the idea of convincing yourself that it's day. That it's the middle of the day. you know, close your eyes maybe and imagine it's the middle, it's midday somehow. And or it may involve magic or mental power, create a visualization of some sort where you actually, because in meditation you'll sometimes see light. You sometimes have your eyes closed and feel like it's the sun is shining down on you, and you open your eyes and there's no light. So it's possible to enter into that state and that perception of light, which is maybe what this means. Number 7 is really useful as well. If you feel drowsy, you should get up and walk. Do walking meditation. Undertake the practice of walking back and forth. And in such, by such means, it is possible that your drowsiness will be abandoned. Now that's 7 ways. The 8th way, if none of that works, then you should lie down. Because sometimes when you're drowsy, you have to sleep. So then you should lie down and be mindful. But this is interesting because it gives a description of the best way to sleep. And this is, first of all, the posture is to lie on your side with one leg on top of the other, one foot overlapping the other, and keep in mind the idea of waking up, the idea of getting up, the idea of standing up. So you lie down to sleep thinking about when you're going to wake up. And the idea here is that you sleep only what you need, and you'll wake up quickly, because as soon as your mind has a chance to be alert, it'll wake up. It'll say, okay, now I'm going to get up. So you lie down, not actually wanting to go to sleep, but you surrender yourself to the fact that maybe you will fall asleep. And so you lie there, you do lying meditation, you do rising, falling, watching the stomach. And then when you fall asleep, as soon as you wake up, you get up. When you awaken, you get up quickly, thinking, I will not be intent on the pleasure of rest, the pleasure of sloth, the pleasure of sleep. Na seya sukhang, na pasu sukhang, na midha sukhang, anuyutto viharisami. I will not dwell attached to the happiness of sleeping, the happiness of, pasa. Of lying, and maybe lying on one's back. The middha sukhang, the pleasure of laziness. And that ends that part of, well, that ends our quote, right? I think. And that part of the sutta is then done. But the sutta doesn't end there. It actually has some important advice, because he goes on kind of thinking, I guess, well, I'm here, I better give Moggallana some more advice on how he should progress. And so he gives some useful advice that's worth relating. He says, you should train yourself. We will not approach families for alms with a head swollen with pride. Because, I mean, maybe it doesn't have much interest for people who don't go on alms, but for those of us that do, what's an important point is that you sometimes go in expecting food or worrying about who's going to give you food and being dejected when people don't give you food. And so it's just this is quite a practical sutta. He's giving a reminder, you know. He says people, the family, sometimes they're busy, sometimes they forget because they're just so busy with other things. And so it's one of the things about being a monk, it's one of the great aspects of the practice of monasticism, is that you really don't know what you're going to eat or how you're going to survive from day to day. And some days you don't survive very well. And so you have to put up with difficulty. It's really a wonderful, I think most people would find it horrific, but it's really quite wonderful when you're forced to deal with uncertainty, and you're relying on people's charity, right? And I mean, it's not only is that very, is that humbling, in the sense that you're really you're not even doing anything for these people. You sometimes question whether you deserve it, or deserve their support. Of course, we can talk about why you might be okay with that. You know, taking it because these people, you're taking it on behalf of the Buddha, right? And then, moreover, you're taking it because you are practicing in a good way, and people respect that. And then, when you have practiced in a good way, you're taking it because, well, in some way, you kind of are deserving of people's support, you know, for the good thing that you've accomplished. But right off track, just the issues of going on alms. Probably not worth going too much into, because don't imagine much of my audience goes on alms. But relating to humility, relating to patience, it's an example of how we should deal with people, and all of us should deal with people. You know, this is a description of a monastic livelihood, how a monk stays alive. But how most people stay alive is they have to go to work, and they still have to deal with people who have various issues that end up causing stress and suffering. So you have to deal with people who are maybe arrogant, your boss or your co-workers, your employees, your customers. And then you have to deal with people who act inexplicably. And if you're not mindful of the fact that these people have issues as well, and that's why they're acting in ways that upset us, it's easy to lose perspective. Important to keep perspective, and remember, this is what this paragraph is saying. Don't forget that people have lives of their own, and everyone's dealing with issues. We often expect too much of other people, and we think, why are they acting that way? When in fact, it's because they're just as messed up as we are. Well, they've got their issues as well. That's what it means. Okay, so after that, he says, we will not, the Buddha says, you should train yourself thus, we will not engage in contentious talk. Another important one, don't sit around and bicker and argue and insult each other and gossip about each other and say nasty things about other people or so on. Because when there's contentious talk, there is an excess of words. When there's an excess of words, one becomes restless. When there is restlessness, one loses one's restraint. The mind of one without restraint is far from concentration. A really good quote. Navigahi katang katesami. We will not speak speech that is divisive or contentious, probably not contentious, quarrelsome, that's a better translation. Because vigahikaya mogalana kataya sati, when there is contentious talk, kata bahulang batikangkang, without doubt there will be lots of talk. Kata bahule sati. The word sati here isn't related to mindfulness. It's a different word that just happens to be spelled the same. It means when there is. Kata bahule sati. When there is kata bahula. Muchness of talk. Udacchang. There will be udaccha, which is restlessness. Udattassa asangvaro. When there is distraction, there will be asangvara, non-restraint. We will not guard our senses because we're too busy talking. We're too distracted. Asangvutasa ara chittang samadhimha. The mind will be far from samadhi. Nahang mogalanna sabbhehi wa sangsangang vannayami. I don't, mogalanna, I don't praise all. I don't praise all, you know, bonding with everyone. No, I don't praise all company, all society. Nor do I praise bonding or nor do I praise society with no one. I do not praise society with householders and monastic. Unless it gives a clever thing. I do not praise associating with householders and monastic, but I do praise associating with quiet and noiseless lodgings. So what is the company that the Buddha prefers us to have? Company of empty places. Company of quiet and noiseless lodgings. The Buddha was so awesome. His teachings are very rich. It's kind of just a clever, actually, somewhat humorous, if you look at it that way. Na panahang mogalana sabheva samsagang na vanayam sagahatta pabad Dehi ko hang mogalana sangsagam na vannayami. I don't praise associating with and hanging out with other recluses, other sorts of, or other recluses, I guess. Or lay people, right? Yani chakotani senasanani appasadani. Whatever dwellings there are that are of little sound, appaningosani, of little busyness, maybe? Ningosa, shouting. Vijanavatani, which have an atmosphere of solitude. Manusara hasayakani, which are far from humans. Patisalana sarupani, which are the sort of being secluded. It is with such senasana, with such dwellings, that I encourage you to associate with. Those should be your companions. Companions should be, you should think of your secluded place. For many of us, that might be our bedroom. Or if you have a spot in the forest, you can say, hello, spot in the forest, and that will be your companion. What else do they say? Oh, and then the Venerable Moggallana asks the Buddha, briefly, Bhante, kitavatanuko Bhante bhikkhusankhitena. How, in what way, Venerable Sir, is a bhikkhu briefly or quickly or by, in summary, Tanha sankhaya vimutto. How does one become free from the It's interesting. The freedom and complete destruction, or through complete destruction of craving. Ajanta nitto. Complete extinction. Ajanta yoga kema. Through the absolute freedom from bondage. Ajanta brahmachari. The completion of the holy life. Ajanta prayosana. The ultimate consummation, no, the ultimate ending, ultimate ending. How does one reach the ultimate? In brief. So he's I guess he's a little bit stuck in his practice. He's drowsing off probably because his mind is not focused in the right way. So he wants some advice on how to focus himself. And why I'm going through this is because this next quote is actually quite important. It's a very good general quote. The Buddha says, Ida Moggallana Bhikkhu no Suttang Hoti. Here Moggallana a Bhikkhu has heard thus. Sabbe dhamma nalang abhiniwe saya. Now this is a quote that we should all remember, because the Buddha says, here a monk has heard. This is enough. Ewan cetang Moggallana Bhikkhu so sabbang dhammang abhijanati. He comes to know all dhammas, or knows fully all dhammas. When one knows this, sabbe dhamma na lang abhinivesaya. This is what you have to learn. This is the truth that we have to learn. So even just hearing this is the door. This is the knowledge that you need prior to practicing. Is this? Sabbe dhamma, and this is talking about learned knowledge. So it's not something you've understood for yourself. If you want to know, when you start to practice, what should you know intellectually? What should you understand about the practice intellectually? What is the claim that you should be aware of, that you're investigating? And this is that claim. Sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesaya. All dhammas are not worth clinging to. And by all dhammas, it means including Nibbana, including practice, everything. No Dhamma is worth clinging to. Insofar as one has heard thus, sabbe Dhamma nalang, or once one has heard thus, then they come to know all Dhammas. Sabbang Dhammang abhinyaya, when they have come to know, and by know here means actually know through experience. Abhi janati. Abhi means in a higher sense. Janati. Janati means he knows. Abhi janati means to know in a higher sense. So from experience, from meditation. Sabang dhammang abhinyaya, having known through experience all dhammas. Sabang dhammang parijanati, which is interesting because parijanati is. Well, it says here knows for certain, because pari means all around, knows completely, maybe is what you can say. Sabang dhammang parinyaya, having known for certain all dhammas, yang kinchi vedanang vediyate, whatever vedana, whatever feeling he experiences, sukhang va dukhang va adukkama sukhang va, whether it be happy feeling, pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, or a neutral feeling. So tasu vedanasu anicchanupassi viharati. He, in regards to those feelings, dwells seeing impermanence. This is deep teaching. So that first part, it was really important because it's general and it's something we should keep in mind. But this is more specific and useful. It gives a description of how our meditation processes. So once you start to practice based on this idea of not clinging, so once you start to be objective, which is what we do when we remind ourselves, saying to ourselves, pain, pain, you're trying to see the experience fully. You see, people criticize this practice. Why are you focusing on the pain? Why are you focusing on the problem? Why not calm the mind, find a way to be free from it? Look at what the Buddha said. Abhijanati, parijanati. You have to know this thing. This is a Dhamma. And you have to know it thoroughly. You have to know it completely. You have to know it in a higher sense. Fully understand it. And when you do that, then you see the impermanence of it. You see that it's not you who fixes it. It's not you who it's not you who it's not trying to fix it that solves the problem, because it's unsure, it's uncertain. Is it going to go? Is it going to stay? It's not up to you. It's not based on your desire. It's impermanent. And the same goes with, I mean, more importantly, I guess, with the things that you cling to, the things that you want. So you want to be free from pain, for example. That's impermanent. And you start to see that all the things that we cling to, all the pleasures, all the things, happinesses, they're not real happiness. Because you start to see that the things you want, the things you like, are unstable. But so it goes with happy feelings, it goes with painful feelings, it goes with neutral feelings. They're all uncertain. And you start to see that. And it's important, or it's essential, because that is the answer. Once you see the inconstancy of these things, and see that the uncertainty, the instability, the unreliability, then your mind inclines away from them. That's what he's going to say next, right? Viraga nupassi becomes disenchanted. So the desire for them, the desire to fix it, disappears. The desire to keep it, if it's a happy feeling, disappears. Desire to acquire pleasant feelings disappears. You see, enough of that. Nirodha nupassi viharati. Well, seeing the cessation. Patinisaga nupasi. So this is, they start to incline away from. Patinisaga is disinclination. You let go. Letting go, you know, people talk about just let go, you learn to let go, that kind of thing. You don't learn to let go. Not directly. You learn the truth about things. You learn impermanence. Impermanent, suffering, non-self. You learn the nature of things as not amenable to your control or your domination or your ownership. And once you see that, the letting go happens by itself. So tasu vedanasu anicca nupassi viharanto viraga nupassi. When seeing all of this, na kinchi loke upadiyati. This is actually a quote also in the Satipatthana Sutta. He doesn't cling to anything in the world. Natcha kinchi loke upadiyati. Natcha isn't here. Wonder if it is in the variant. Yeah, in other versions it's natcha kinchi loke upadiyati. It just means end. And he doesn't cling, he or she doesn't cling to anything in the world. Anupadiyang na paritasati. Not clinging to anything. He or she doesn't burn, doesn't become. Does it mean burn? Dasati, I think, means burn. No, I'm not sure. Is not tormented. Naparitasati. Aparitasang pachatam yeva parinimbayati. Not being disturbed, not being tormented by these things, because they torment us, right? If pain torments you, if you're worried about it, if you're fussing about it, if you're concerned about it, you know, and this involves trying to fix it. Every time you try to run away from the pain, try to chase away the pain, you hate it more. You get more averse to it, and you build up aversion. But when you let go of it, you don't suffer because of it. You can be in great pain, and you won't suffer. Same goes with happy feelings. Happy feelings torment us when we're chasing them, we want them, and constantly you get them, well, you want them again, you want them more and more and more and more, and you're tormented. Even neutral feelings, you want to be calm, well, you have to work at it, and you're tormented by working again and again for the same calm that doesn't last and doesn't stick. And so giving them up is the way to find true peace. And when you find that peace, when you're no longer disturbed by these things, pachatang eva parinibhayati, you become fully freed. Pachatang, for yourself. And then you say, or you know, you know pajanati, you know fully, kina jati, destroyed his birth, usitang brahmacharyang, lived is the holy life, katang karaniyang, done is what needs to be done, done is what should be done, na parangitatayati, there is nothing further here, there's nothing more than this, this is the end. That's the goal. This is a description of someone who has found the goal. So you talk about goals, you talk about what is the purpose of life, what is the goal. This, according to Buddhism, is the goal. You've found something that is goal-worthy. In other words, it's not something you attain and then you say, well, now what? There is no now what? That's the goal. Kina jati, no more birth. Usitang brahmacharyang, lived is the holy life. You've lived the holy life. You've found the way to be truly holy, truly spiritual, truly enlightened. Katang karaniyang, you've done what should be done. This is, you've found that which really we all should do in truth, not just according to someone's idea, but what in absolute fact should be done. It's something that it's a should. But it's, you know, it's a should in the sense that it's consistent. We want to be happy. There's no one who doesn't really want. There's no one really that doesn't want to be happy. And this is the way that makes you happy. There's no one who doesn't want to be free from suffering. This is the way to be free from suffering. So it's should in that sense. It's should in the sense of being consistent in terms of in line with one's desires. Na parangita tayati bhajanati. There's nothing further. Etavata, and that's actually a fairly common passage. The Buddha giving this again and again, he'll give this sequence. You know, you turn away and then you let go and then you're free. Once you're free, you know I'm free. Etavata ko mogalana bhikkhu sankitena dangka. This is a short exposition, or in brief exposition, how one becomes free through the complete letting go of craving, complete destruction of craving. The ultimate end, the ultimate freedom from bondage, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate ending. Seto deva manusanam. One becomes the greatest among gods and humans. That's the sutta for tonight. What is then Moggallana? No, it doesn't say how Moggallana responds, but we can assume he's actually quite pleased. So that's the Dhamma for tonight. Now I'm posting a link to the Hangout. If anybody has questions, you're welcome to come on. But you got to be brave. You got to be brave enough to show your face on the Hangout. The only other way you can, if you really want to talk, then there's a requirement that you undertake a daily meditation practice. You have to be doing meditation in our tradition at least an hour a day, and then I'll take you through a course of meditation, and we meet once a week. So for those of you who haven't found out about this and are interested, you can go to the Meet page, meditation.surimangalo.org. And on the Meet page, there are quite a few available slots. So we still have 13 people signed up. I was actually talking to someone yesterday who seemed to think they had signed up, but I don't really know, because they're not on the list. And then they called me while I was doing meditation at 7:30, and I'm debating back and forth, but I told them, you know, I'm doing meditation now. I've started my timer, and everyone's all concerned that I'm actually meditating, so I figure I should actually, you know, there's a debate here whether it's proper to accept when anyone tries to get a hold of you, you know, do what you can for them, or whether it's proper to concern yourself with your own schedule. I think it's, as I was saying, I think it can be important to not make it too easy for people to get access, you know, because what I'm seeing lately is there's less appreciation, you know, people calling me up on the phone anonymously and not telling me their names and asking me questions that are not related to the goal. That kind of thing is happening. On the other hand, I've had some really good meetings. Today, a lot of people cry when I talk with them, which is heartwarming. I mean, it's funny because, you know, you make people cry, which is on the face not a good thing, but talked with someone today who's going through some fairly serious issues emotionally. I mean, they said, you know, I've got it really good, and, you know, I'm not suffering, I'm not being abused or anything, but a lot of emotional issues with family and that kind of thing. Didn't really go into it in detail, which is, of course, not important, but wanted to learn how to meditate, so I sat there and explained to them how to meditate. But the crying came when we started talking about emotions and looking at them, you know, not trying to avoid them, and that's a pretty emotional time when you actually feel like you're given the opportunity to experience your emotions, to let them out. It's quite freeing. And so this person started crying. And then we talked some more, and then probably about 15, 20 minutes, maybe not even that much, maybe 15 minutes of meditation together. Oh, and they skipped their class. The shocking thing was they were supposed to have a class, but they said, she said, that, you know, she knew she'd go to class and she just wouldn't be able to focus. She wouldn't be able to put her energy because she was just at a point where, anyway, I don't know if I want to get into details of people's personal lives, otherwise they find out and they're like, that was told in confidence, but no, I'm not giving personal details. And it's important that you know, we appreciate such people and their problems, and it's heartwarming to be able to help. So this, at the end, she said she felt better. And one thing I always feel when I talk, you know, take this time with these people, is I'm not ever sure if they're going to follow through with it. Some of these people I never see again. Some of them I do. On the other hand, it's kind of amazing how, you know, years later you might hear from someone, or you don't hear from them, but I guess if you don't hear from them, you don't know, but there is a suspicion that a lot of people just go off and have their life improved. Because there's a lot of people who say that, you know, for all the negative comments that I get, or I guess anyone in this position might get, there's so many positive comments, and they far outweigh the negative. It's a funny phenomenon on the internet. People always focus on the negative. So you write a post, and you get 100 positive responses, and then you get one negative response. And you say, oh no, everyone hates me. It's easy to focus on the negative. But what I meant by this was, it's encouraging how much positive there is. And people, and just, you know, just one person saying, wow, your videos have really helped me and, you know, improved my life in this way and that way. I mean, is that not worth it? Does that not make it a good thing? We were talking today with this person who I was talking to. The question was about helping people. Because she, like me, is the sort of person who likes to help people or has always wanted to help people. I said, well, you know, the real reason to help people, first off, is because it's the right thing to do. You shouldn't help people really because, as a goal, because there's always more people to help. I mean, if that's your goal, you're not really doing much. And moreover, helping others is not really how it works. You have to, if you don't help yourself, and if they don't help themselves, the solution is not to help others or to have others help you. The solution is to help yourself. So teaching others to help yourself, but the only way you can teach others to help yourself is if you actually know how to help yourself and therefore are helping yourself. So helping others is much more about being the right thing to do and how it impacts your life. When you help others, it makes you feel happy, it makes you feel confident, it makes you feel good. It gives strength to your mind. I got a couple of people on my hangout. Who are you guys? I don't know either of you. Michael.
You probably know me as Boobie from the meditation forum.
Sorry, my volume's low. Say that again.
You probably know me as Boobie Chat from the meditation forum.
As who?
Boobie Chat.
Oh, yeah. Huh. And
I'm Felix from London. Actually, I just found out the meditation link actually this yesterday. I've seen a few of your YouTube clips in the past, but just found it by accident. The reason not just recently I've been started meditating quite a lot, and one thing came to my curiosity. The thought came to my curiosity that I never thought as a question. I have one wondering question that I would like to know regarding Buddhism. Sorry, I haven't introduced really myself actually. I am from Burma.
That's what I thought.
I'm Burmese, but I live in London now.
Mingalabak.
And when I found you last night, you're watching your thoughts replay a YouTube clip. It's kind of very hard to see a monk teaching about Theravada Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate of your knowledge and your of Dhamma.
Well, thank you.
I don't know how what is appropriate. Is it could I ask a question that I would like to ask? Actually, to the question is to any monk, you know, someone who could, a literature monk who can be able to answer. I was hoping that probably you might be able to answer it.
I can answer it, whether it's a good answer or not.
Yes.
You have to judge for yourself.
The question is like this, Bande. As a Buddhist, you know, our goal is to achieve Nirvana, right?
Mm.
Let's say one being, if he or she attain like once in a Nirvana by practicing Vipassana, that means he is like a thought. He attained like a thought of the Meg. Correct. Correct me if I'm wrong.
That's correct. Yes.
And what would happen to that being? Let's say if he pass away after he attained Totapati Mag.
Mm-hmm.
As in after next life, next life, whatever he may be, a human or I don't know they were, whatever in his next life, how would the person know what he has achieved in his previous life?
Well,
he wouldn't know.
They wouldn't necessarily. A Sotapanna wouldn't. I mean, mostly they would. Mostly they're going to be born in heaven. And they're born upapadika, right? So upapadika, which means they're born immediately. And so there's no 9 months in the womb. There's no losing of one's memories. There's no obscurity. It's immediate.
Yeah.
So
yes, I have read that in the past and somewhere in the book.
Angels remember everything. But if they're born as a human, they may not remember. It's not necessary to remember. The necessary thing, the important thing is that a sotapanna has broken. It's like if you have a dam, you know, a dam with that keeps water in?
Yes.
It's like the dam is broken, it's cracked. That crack is never going to be fixed. You can't fix it anymore. So they've cracked. And it's only a matter of time before the dam bursts. So their whole being, or maybe another way of looking at it is, if you lose a limb, a sotapanna is like someone who has lost a limb, and that limb is not coming back. Or even, it's even more extreme than that. They've lost most of their suffering. You know, most of their ability to suffer is gone. And so that aspect of their being, is the root of that is gone. Maybe you could look at it like that, is the root. You have many trees, and so some of them have been uprooted.
Yes, so, correct. So I understood that.
If they're born as a human being, they may not remember their sotapanna, but they can't kill. They can't steal. That part of
correct,
them is gone.
Yes.
The part that would lead them to do that is uprooted. It's no longer a part of who they are. It's not even there.
So in that second life, assuming that he is reborn as a human life,
mm-hmm.
then if he practices like a vipassana in this life again, when he attains second time as a nirvana, it's going to be the Dagami Mike, right?
Not necessarily.
So what?
Next time, see, because there's the attainment of fruition. A sotapanna, technically it's the same. It is, but it's... You see, the Sakadagami is only a technical. Sotapatti and Sakadagami are just technical. They're like landmarks. Each time you realize Nibbana, it's just pala samapati. But it's making you more pure until it makes you so pure that you get to the point where you could only be reborn one more time, and that's Sakadagami or Sakadagami, right? But that's just a landmark. The next time you experience it, you probably still be a sotapanna. And you experience Nibbana many, many times and eventually become Sakadagami. And you experience enough times from there, it become Anagami. But it's not usually one time. It depends on the person. Some people it's very quick, like Sariputta and so on. They went through all four very quickly. That can happen. But for most people it's many, many, many times.
Yes, for that being, will he know if he or she, what I was thinking is, assuming that he might have attained Nirvana in his past life,
mm-hmm.
and in this life, if he practiced Vipassana again,
mm-hmm.
and assuming he attained, because he will be starting from Tathagami Phala, right?
Mm-hmm.
In this life. So if he carry on practicing Vipassana second time, if he attain or purify his defilements, then how do he know that is he attained that Tathagami Mak?
He may not know.
This life? He may not know.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, and that's true even in this life. A sotapanna in this life may not, when you become sotapanna, you may not know your sotapanna. A Pacheka Buddha, I don't know about that actually. A Pacheka Buddha probably knows that they're a Pacheka Buddha, probably knows that they have accomplished something. But even there, there's a sense that there are many things they don't know. But definitely, I guess I'd want to say that an Arahant is pretty clear what they've done, what they've accomplished.
Yes.
But a Sotapanna, even an Anagami, probably pretty clear. But an Arahant knows what they... But you know, if you're reborn, and suppose you're reborn where there's no Buddhists around, right? As you say, they may not know. They may not have words for it. An Arahant may be like, wow, you know, I'm free from, you know, all defilements. But, you know, they may not even use those words. They say, wow, you know, I'm totally free, totally pure. They might just know it like that.
Yes.
They might not know the word arahant or anagami or nibbana or anything. That's possible. It's unlikely. You know, it's more likely that they're born closer to Buddhists and, you know, have access because of the direction their mind is heading. But it's not necessary.
Yes.
Now, it's only a Buddha that really has knowledge of all these things.
Yes.
The rest of us, we get knowledge from the Buddha. A lot of our background information is from, you know, ability to express what we've experienced comes from the Buddha, doesn't come from our experience. You know, we couldn't express these things in so many words unless we had the Buddha's teaching to rely upon. So what we just talked about tonight is more what they feel. They feel, Musitang brahmacharyang, I've lived a pure life. Katang karniyang, I've done what needs to be done. Na parang itataya, there is nothing further from here. They'll know that. That's what an arahant knows. Now, Sotapanna probably doesn't know things nearly as clearly. They get a sense something happened and something's different. But
yeah,
it's not clear what that is.
Yeah.
Even Sakadagami is not still so clear. Good questions.
Sorry about asking like a question that probably, because I've never thought about it, you know, this thing before. I was a Buddhist, you know, since I was, my family background, I'm originally from Burma, so I was born as a Buddhist. But I'm not following, even though as a Buddhist, you know, I don't approach to, how can I say, not very religious,
mm-hmm.
as in the sense,
sure,
that not going to the monastery or something like that, you know, but
mm-hmm.
I grew up, you know, all the Buddhist knowledge to me came from through the books. I read
mm-hmm.
through the books, went around, was teenage quite a long time ago.
Well, still, it's better than most of us. You've got the background.
Yes. Actually, I found out, you know, a lot of... there's a Buddhist society or like a knowledge, you know, you can read through online. I will share it on the meditation site.
Yeah, there's some good
regarding Theravada Buddhism, you know, like a Tipitaka and all the books in English. I'm reading back through, you know, what I found it now, because now that I'm in England.
Right. Well, glad to have you. Welcome. We practice. Are you aware? Would we the meditation that we practice at this site?
Yes, I've been looking through Mahasi Seyaro technique. Is I have read about his, you know, books in the past while I was in Burma a long time ago.
You can you have access to the Burmese, no?
Yes, correct. But not all the books are with me. I was lucky enough, you know. I received all those books because of my father, you know, like a father inheritance, I would say.
There's even, you know, this Burmese Dhamma site that has all sorts of talks by Sayadaws in Burmese, like MP3 files?
Yes, they do.
Like Dhamma
yes.
Download, I think it's called, or something. There's
yes,
some in
sir.
English, but so much in Burmese. And
yeah, there's a lot in Burmese, I noticed that too.
Yeah.
Yes, correct.
So you're very lucky to have that. I was living with a Burmese nun you know, for many years. We were working together in many different places, and so I showed her on the computer, and I actually downloaded many of these talks, and she would just sit there and listen to all these sayadaws. She was so happy, because in Thailand she didn't have access to the... We're living in Thailand, so she didn't have access, so
yes.
She was very happy to have those.
Yes, correct. Sometimes, you know, Dhamma is like, you know, even though, like you said, you know, I'm from Burma, sometimes I realize even my close family, like my, you know, and or other friends, some Burmese people, the way they see Buddhism is not deeply or, you know, as you know that
Sure.
they should be.
Yeah. No, you really
Is
need you need something to trigger it.
yes, correct.
Yeah. But all of that is like the soil. And it's very good, you know, living in such societies, it's very easy for people to. There was a Thai monk who said this. He said, you know, yeah, many people don't have proper understanding of Buddhism or appreciation of Buddhism, but the bridge is there. They can cross the bridge anytime they want. It's very easy for them because they've prepared themselves. It's like they're the soil. They've prepared the soil. All they have to do is plant the seed because the soil is good. He was saying this in regards to a cult in Thailand that developed non-Buddhist Dhamma, so that they said Nibbana is Atta, Nibbana is self, and other things that are contrary to the Dhamma. And he said, the problem here is they're burning the bridges. So it's kind of like they destroy the soil. They poison the soil. When you poison the soil, you can't plant the seed. So the problem we have in the West, I think, is we're trying to plant it in sand. We don't have the soil. In Buddhist countries, you have a good soil. Most people, good soil. And this is why meditation is very easy to teach in those countries. Like I found in Thailand, you know, when you do teach meditation, you get really good results. From the people.
I can appreciate.
Yeah. It's just a matter of getting people to meditate, but it, you know, really good results. Not quite to say, I mean, it's not to say in the West we're hopeless, because in fact there are many good qualities in non-Buddhist societies, and you can find people like that. But you also get people who have a hard time. A lot of us have a hard time meditating because we don't have the soil. A lot of Buddhist teachers say things like, you know, Westerners don't have the morality, the generosity, the basic qualities of goodness. You know, goodness is not held in such high esteem. Even in religions that talk about goodness, their focus is usually on something else. Like in Christianity, they talk about goodness, but their focus is on God, not good. And in other religions, similar, you know. So goodness is talked about, but never central. In Buddhism, goodness is central, because we don't talk about God or Buddha. We talk mostly about punya. What do you say in Burmese? What do you say?
Pinya.
Ping is the word? Pinya?
Pinya. You mean the wisdom, right?
No, that's panya. Punya. Do you know punya?
Punya.
Punya. You say punya. Okay.
Yes.
Punya. Anyway, nice to meet you, both
nice
of you. Michael, did you have a question?
I did. It's kind of a good segue about reconstituting a more a regular meditation practice that I've kind of unfortunately fallen out of a bit.
I hear you.
Yeah, I was doing it very regularly. Like 3+ times a day, and then there was about a month or so where I just kind of stopped. And I really don't have any reason for it, but I've been getting back into it, and I'm finding it somewhat challenging.
Well, the thing about meditation is you can start any time, and you have to start all the time. So you just have to do it.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
Sorry?
Kind of what I was thinking, you would say, that it'd be more kind of strict with myself.
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, you can't force it, and it doesn't help to really set regimens because it's impermanent, you know. You're meditating now or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to start looking at it in a different way, because if you force yourself to meditate, it may not be as fruitful as if you try to let it become natural to you. You know, yes, it's good to do a daily practice, but as far as sustaining that, I mean, there are artificial ways of sustaining it. If you do a course with me, then that's a big part of it, is not so much the knowledge that I give you, but just the pressure. Oh, I better do it an hour a day because he's not going to be happy with me if I don't. That can, I mean, it's not even quite that, but just that It's why learning in school is so much easier than learning on your own. I was trying to learn languages. I was trying to do studies on my own, and without a teacher, without a teacher pushing you, it's much, much more difficult. So psychologically, having a teacher is quite useful.
You think doing something like a retreat like that is a good way to maybe kickstart back into a
Well,
regular.
if you're doing this technique, another aspect of that is what I teach to the public is just the very first step. We don't give you 90% of it. 90% of it you have to get through a course, and I give you a new exercise every day. So, in this tradition, really everyone in our forum should be going through this course if they're keen on continuing in this tradition. Really, everyone should do that. And I like the requirement of you doing 1 hour a day, because that filters out people who maybe aren't serious. You've really got to be keen on this. Are you going to put up and do 1 hour a day? But it's not, I don't think that's an onerous task. In the end, by the end of the course, I want you to be up to 2 hours a day, which is also still not that onerous, but it is quite a commitment.
Well, and see, that's where I was before,
Sure, but
falling off
you were
platform.
only doing the first step, right? Stepping right, stepping left, rising, falling.
Right,
That's
yeah.
only the very beginning of the practice. So, I would say it starts to lose its, I mean, to some extent, it loses its power as you get better at it, because you're not challenged so much anymore. You'd find it much easier to continue if you had more steps, I think.
Maybe I should look into that then. It's spring break coming up next week,
You
so
don't
maybe
need a
that'd be a
spring break.
perfect
You just need
opportunity.
to. You just need 1 hour a day. And you start.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you have the time to do it, you just don't do it.
Well, do a course, and you'll make time. You'll see
Yeah.
the psychology of having a teacher. It's quite powerful.
Yeah. You feeling better?
Better, not 100%. We're talking about it in class today. One of my classmates, she's at least my age, probably older, but we both have this sickness. And it's weird, you get getting hot flashes and dizziness and tired. It's been 2 weeks already, which is a long time for sickness. And resting doesn't seem to help, meditation doesn't seem to help.
You maybe think something about
Although then
shavasana.
I told this to the other person, and she said, "Well, not resting, not meditating probably make it worse." And you're probably right. It's probably helping to keep it from getting worse.
If it's something like mono or
Mono.
mononucleosis.
Yeah, I think it's just a flu. She was saying someone had this for 6 weeks or something.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound fun.
That's lots of fun.
Good meditation object.
Yeah, it makes school work a little bit challenging, but I was trying to explain my thesis to our teacher's assistant today, and I said, "Wait a second, wait a second. I'll wait for my brain to catch up."
You're still going over the Lotus Sutra?
Sorry?
You're still going over the Lotus Sutra?
Yeah. Yeah, and she asked me, whether I was going to rely upon secondary source opinions, or whether I was going to try to give my own opinion. I said, no, I know not to give my own opinions. I know I've been burnt by that before. I said, if I was going to write an essay from my point of view, I would be, what is the word? I would be, what was the word I used? Strongly. Not critical, but worse than critical. Can't remember what the word I used was. Yeah, I would be quite negative about it. Not impressed. And I think a point has to be made that the Lotus Sutra goes beyond the Mahayana, which is quite interesting to me. The Mahayana was the idea of it being better to become a Buddha, which the Theravada agrees with. We'll agree that becoming a Buddha is far, far superior. It's just that, you know, we don't believe that most people can or should. Can is maybe debatable, but should, you know, it's just not necessary, especially now that we have the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha did this so people could become enlightened, and then to say, no, let's not, you know, walk through the door that was opened for us. It's kind of, well, what happens when next time someone becomes a Buddha? They're going to say the same thing, then what was it all for, right? What good is it to become a Buddha if you're expecting everybody else to become Buddhas? No one's listening to me.
It does seem a little self-insistent.
A little what?
Self-insistent. And I think you actually said a bit sophistic as well.
Sophistic, yeah. But the Lotus Sutra, so anyway, that's an argument we can have, and we can appreciate the Mahayana to that extent. Anyone who wants to become a Buddha should be appreciated. But what I don't appreciate, the Lotus Sutra, I don't really appreciate. I'm sorry for all those millions of people who do look at it as a very, very important text. I don't.
I see that.
It goes further and says you have to become a Buddha, and the Buddha was lying. And it says, no, it's not a lie. It's not a lie, but, you know, what they're saying is saying something that is not true in this instance is not a lie. That's basically what they're saying. And okay. they expand the idea of expedient means to include what we would call immoral acts, lying. You know, that lying is somehow proper. And they say it's not lying. And then they explain how it's not lying. And if you look at their explanation, you think, well, you know, that is lying. It might be a white lie, if you want to call it that. So the idea that becoming an arahant or a pachika Buddha is not real. It was just an expedient means. The Buddha was tricking us so that we would get out of the fire. But a really interesting, I don't know, picking it apart is kind of interesting. What I'm focusing on in my essay, though, is how the text has been adapted and how its adaptations are what's made it famous, not the actual content or purpose of the sutta. Because the Lotus Sutra was directed towards Indian Buddhists who needed to be convinced or had an idea that there were three vehicles. And so it's saying, no, there's only one vehicle. Now, that argument is lost on East Asian Buddhists for whom the Lotus Sutra is so important. You know, nowadays I suppose it isn't, but at the time it wouldn't have resonated in the same way because, well, they didn't have the three vehicles. There wasn't a deeply ingrained sense of that. So the focus in East Asian Buddhism is much more on in general, it's always been much more on the inspirational aspects of this sutta. If you recite it, it will lead you to the Pure Land. So that led to Pure Land Buddhism, that it will get you everything you want. And so that led to Nichiren Buddhism. I mean, not exactly. And they would be harshly critical of what I just said because they would say, no, they're focusing on the wisdom in the sutta. I just argue that there's not much wisdom in the sutta. Yeah, there's some nice pithy sayings, but they're few and far between. It's mostly just self-aggrandizing, self-appreciatory, self-praising. The Lotus Sutra is so great, the Lotus Sutra is so great. Well, what is the Lotus Sutra? It spends 90% of its time praising itself and warning against anyone who denigrates it. So I'm going to hell because I don't appreciate the Lotus Sutra. I mean, it's for someone, and I was talking about this in class today, as someone who considers themselves following an Indian, mainstream Indian Buddhist tradition, I am the audience to a great extent, except for the fact that I'm a Westerner in modern Western society, grown up there. You know, insofar as I'm a Theravada Buddhist monk, I am the audience of the Lotus Sutra, or I am part of the audience. So my impression of it is actually what the expected, you know, sort of dialogue. You know, and I see it, I would think, a lot clearer than people who follow East Asian Buddhism and who see it through the lens of such reinterpretation. Because they don't have the background in, you know, the original text that this text was addressing. I look at it and I say, oh yeah, I know what they're doing there. I see. They're appropriating this concept. They actually quote, you know, iti piso bhagava, the reciting the qualities of the Buddha. It's actually in the Lotus Sutra, verbatim. They just copied it in, and then they go on and adapt it and talk about what else the Buddha was. I mean, it's really, it's so, because a lot of it is, you know, I know the tradition that it comes from. I'm very familiar with the tradition that this grew out of. But it's so, it's like it took sort of the inspirational aspects of mainstream Buddhism and cubed them. You know, it just exponentially took it to a whole other order of magnitude. And so you've got exaggerations of the Buddha. These Buddhas stick their tongue out, because the Buddha said to have a long tongue that he could touch his nose or even his ears. I don't know. But these Buddhas stuck their tongue out all the way to the Brahma realm and held them out for 10,000 years or 1,000 years, 1,000 years maybe. And you're wondering, what the heck, what? I mean, and they will all be interpreted. They will have, in East Asia, and this is sort of what I'm looking at, is the interpretations, but, and okay, maybe that is a passage that is supposed to be interpreted, because I can't figure it out for the life of me. Sticking your tongue out for 1,000 years, why is this in a Buddhist sutta in the first place? So if you're going to interpret that, if there's an interpretation, and there probably is, maybe that passage actually has. There's one passage that I really like from the Lotus Sutra that I have to admit is pretty awesome. You know, kind of awesome. It's not a teaching that I would promote, but I kind of think, you know, that's noble. And it's well said as well. It's, if you want to teach the Lotus Sutra, you have to wear the Buddha's robe. There's three things. Wear the Buddha's robe, sit on the Buddha's throne, and one other thing that I can't remember. And so that sounds kind of terrible, you know, but what it means, and then it explains what it means by that. Wearing the Buddha's robe means having the Buddha's humility, I think. Sitting on the Buddha's throne means having the Buddha's compassion. There's three things: humility, compassion, and something else. And these are the metaphor of the Buddha's robes, his seat, and something else. I can't remember. But that's kind of nice. You know, there's the good qualities. And that's an actual teaching, I guess, is the point, because so much of it is, to me, not really useful teachings. It's more just, and some of it's ridiculous, like this serpent princess, 8-year-old serpent princess, Naga princess, gives a gem to the Buddha, which, you know, why is the Buddha accepting gems in the first place? I mean, I don't know, I follow a tradition that is very strict about such things. The Buddha would not accept gems. And anyway, it's all allegorical or whatever. Anyway, she says, you see how quickly I gave him that gem? That's how quickly I'm going to become a Buddha. So this 8-year-old non-human girl, after giving him the gem, in the snap of a fingers becomes a Buddha. I mean, it's that kind of thing that, you know, just, what religion is this? I don't recognize it anymore. And, you know, I mean, a lot of it they would argue is just metaphorical or whatever, but metaphorical or not, the teaching behind it is not my Buddhism. Anyway, I've gone on and on and on about the Lotus Sutra. Probably not going to win me too many fans, but I think it's important. It's important that we address this, especially because it's such a famous sutta. And I think, I guess I would like to have some dialogue with some people, because last time I talked about this, I got at least two people commenting. One who was a really good friend of mine, Backmoon Ward is his actual name. And I didn't actually get back to him, but he said, it's actually not what you think, and if you study the Lotus Sutra in depth, it means something quite different, which I appreciate, but I think it's much more about how it's been interpreted than about what it was actually intended to do. Most people who study the Lotus Sutra now are in a totally different frame of thought than the original authors, and interpret it in ways that it, I'm 90% sure it wasn't meant to be interpreted, or it wasn't expected to be interpreted. So, you know, whether that's valid or not, I guess that is valid.
Well, it does have a huge proliferation.
Sorry?
People really like to cite the Lotus Sutra, you know, they're number one. And, you know, I don't know. I agree with you. I don't really, I don't appreciate it very much, but.
Yeah, I mean, if you study the Theravada Buddhist texts, you can't help but see the difference. That there is, and they would say, well, yeah, because the Theravada Buddhist texts are inferior and they're just a limited teaching. And I couldn't disagree more, because I find them, you know, what we just studied tonight, that is a teaching. That is practical and strong, and you know, you said there's nothing more here, you know. So this text is a lie. According to the Lotus Sutra, this text, which we just said, is you know, it's a bald-faced lie that you can't get beyond that, because he's telling Moggallana, they understand there's nothing more here. Na parang itataya. There's nothing further. And they say, well, actually, you know, they may know that, but they're wrong. Guess what? They have to become a Buddha now. So, anyway. Probably should go. It's way long. We've been here over an hour. So nice to meet you both. Thank you
Sure.
for
Thank you,
joining
Bhante.
me, and thanks everyone for tuning in. Have a good night.
Good night.
You too.